cymbals.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome. Good. We'll do a little call and response. That's wonderful. Welcome to the commencement ceremonies for the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. Welcome to the Goldman School faculty behind me here. We're all wearing our colors. This is the time of year where we get to wear robes and have our colors and act like the gang that we are, which is a lot of fun. Also, welcome to the students and the staff and the families. So, my name is Henry Brady. It's my privilege to be the Dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. And today, we're here to honor, celebrate, and to congratulate the Goldman School of Public Policy Class of 2014. You know, what a great time to be graduating from a public policy school and to be embarking upon a career of public service. Events around the world, a weak government in Ukraine, a feeble and poorly performing government in Nigeria, an autocratic despotism in North Korea, and the ongoing stories of disorder in the Middle East, these events show us how important it is to have governments. Government is good. Government can do good things that can protect and serve their societies, and to have strong nonprofit sector that can provide services for and give voice to people in need. The world needs public servants who can act ethically and who can get things done and who can provide leadership and innovation. The Goldman School of Public Policy, through its, and I know you're all waiting for me to say this, its tripartite set of goals. The students mock me at the talent show over this. I appreciate it, but this is what we're about. We're about excellence. Being the best public policy school in the country, in the world. We're about mission. We want the world to be a better place. And we mean that, sincerely. And ultimately, we're about community, because the way that you make a world a better place is to build communities, communities that can help people become better at what they do and what they want to do. And that's what the Goldman School of Public Policy does. And the proof of how well we do it is in what we've already done. Our graduates have been Secretary of Agriculture, California's legislative analyst, Ambassador to the Kyrgyz Republic, Commissioner of U.S. Public Buildings, President and CEO of the Associated Press, President of the College Access Fund, and it just goes on and on and on. And by the way, many of those are women who have achieved those things, graduates of the public policy program here at Berkeley. And in fact, Nani Coloretti, class of 1994, just 20 years ago, just had her confirmation hearing to become second in command at the Department of Housing and Urban Development in Washington, D.C. Now, unfortunately, it's not clear when her nomination will be approved by the Senate, but nevertheless, she has had her hearing, and she should be uncontroversial given her tremendous achievements as Assistant Secretary and Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Treasury. By the way, an interesting story about Nani is that because of her background, when they were putting together the local schools committee, she was named the treasurer of the organization because they felt that as Assistant Secretary of the Department of Treasury, she might know something about that. So our graduates do everything. And we know that you will do wonderful things, just as the many graduates who have come before you have done great things. So every day, in fact, I am buoyed by the fact that my office just leads directly into what we call the living room, where there are typically 10, 20, 30 students or more sitting there working, talking about public policy, economics, statistics, how you make the world a better place. You're sometimes blocking my door. I walk out. In the winter, you sit next to the radiator outside my door to keep warm. And I'm always amused to see people basically sort of crunched up by the radiator trying to keep the foggy days a little warmer for themselves. You'll also put electrical wires there because there's some plugs nearby. So I walk out and I trip sometimes. I take this all as friendly acts, that you feel that you can be blocking my office and I will not take offense. But the marvelous and wonderful thing is it allows me every day to see what you are doing and to really get the sense of your intensity, of your focus, of your competence. And it's truly thrilling. I sometimes say I'm sort of an alien and I live off the brain waves of the students in the living room. I walk out and I can just feel myself smiling and happy and excited over the notion that our students are learning and advancing their careers. And it's just tremendously exciting. I've been thrilled by this proximity to you, inspired by it, and every day you enrich my life and enrich the lives of our faculty and of our staff. So I thank you. But most importantly, through your IPAs, your internships, and your APAs, and the other work you do, you have already contributed in many, many ways to making the world a better place. I figure that if they actually paid us for the IPAs and APAs we did each year, that would be about $500,000 in consulting work that we would do every year for the state of California, for cities in California, for the nation, and for the world. That's pretty remarkable. Now, one of the most exciting things about being dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy is I get to meet you once you become alumni, and you come to some of our events in Washington or Sacramento or San Francisco or Oakland or elsewhere. And so I'm really looking forward to watching you as you go off and do extraordinary things. Nothing could be more important right now than to have dedicated, committed, thoughtful, and immensely talented people who want to solve the world's problems. You are those people. And I feel blessed that I've had the chance to grow with you, to learn from you, and to see you advance over the last 2 years. I'll watch with even greater anticipation as I see you go out and do extraordinary things. So thank you. So, this event means a lot to all of us in different ways, but there's some people who are especially important, and it's not just you, the graduates. It's your families, your spouses, your partners, your children, and the friends who have supported you. So I want to stop and thank them for all that they have done. Thanks for what you've done. We really, and I'm looking above your heads now, out there to the crowd, to the people who have really supported you and helped you and given you an opportunity to be where you are today. Yes. Said very well. Graduates, through your hard work and determination during your time at GSBP, you've successfully completed your degree, and today you are joining in a community of GSBP alums of close to 2,000 people. This network is really important for us. It's people you can rely upon as you move forward in your careers. As the newest group of alumni, we look forward to all the exciting work that lies ahead of you and to seeing what you become. So, congratulations and good luck to the class of 2014. So with that, I would like to introduce GSBP alum, Enrique Ruacho, who will say a few words on behalf of the GSBP Alumni Association. In a sense, this is passing on to you that now you join our alumni. You become folks that have been at the Goldman School and are now going out into the larger world. Enrique is a GSBP graduate of just 2012, just 2 years ago. And he's currently a district representative for California State Senator Hannah Beth Jackson. Enrique also currently serves on the GSBP Alumni Association Board of Governors. Enrique, there you are.
Thanks. Well, thank you very much for that, Dean Brady. I really appreciate it. And I also appreciated some of your jokes, which I think I remember from 2012.
Well, they got better, didn't they?
Oh, yes, they did. They definitely did. Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Enrique Ruacho, and I'm a graduate of the class of 2012. And as Dean Brady said, I'm a district representative for California State Senator Hannah Beth Jackson. She represents Santa Barbara and Ventura counties. And I'm also a member of the GSBP Alumni Association Board of Directors for 2013-2014 academic year. And I am pleased to stand before you today to congratulate you for completing your public policy degree from the number one public policy school in the world. So congratulations for that. On behalf of the Goldman School alumni community, I officially welcome you to the Goldman School of Public Policy Alumni Association. As an alumnus of UC Berkeley and the Goldman School, I am confident that you will take this degree and make a difference in the work that you will do. Today, you will join a community of GSBP alumni who are dedicated to making the world a better place and who are committed to advancing GSBP, its faculty, staff, and most importantly, its students and alumni. As our newest members of the GSBP Alumni Association, there are several ways in which you can give back to your alma mater. Think of it as a cost-benefit analysis, given your past 2 years at GSBP. So By volunteering your time to help, you can help by volunteering your time with current students as well as prospective students, providing opportunities and connections for internships, IPAs, APAs, or jobs, and giving back financially. You are transforming generations of women and men into public policy leaders while strengthening an alumni network that will work for you. We look forward to working with you on these endeavors. Again, on behalf of the Goldman School of Public Policy Alumni Association and its board of directors, welcome to the Alumni Association and congratulations, class of 2014. And now it is my pleasure to welcome Van Nguyen to the podium, who was selected by the class of 2014 as this year's student speaker. Van.
I don't have enough money to pay you all to do that. Maybe in a couple months after I pay the Alumni Association. This is really cool. Hold on, I'm just going to take a quick picture because this is like, it's really cool. Take a quick selfie. You know, nothing says I'm ready to enter the real world quite like a selfie. Distinguished faculty, staff, family and friends, and most importantly, graduates, good morning and congratulations to the Goldman School class of 2014. It's truly an honor to have been selected by you to be our class speaker. I consider myself fortunate just to even be here today. You know, it's been a tough season for commencement speakers here in the United States. And I want to thank you for not staging a protest for previous controversial positions I've taken in the past. I've never been a big fan of Free Coffee Wednesdays. Yet another example of lavish government handouts. That's true. So all kidding aside, I take my task today very seriously. When I found out 3 weeks ago that I was going to be your class speaker, I prepared with the same intensity that many of you applied to, say, an APA or an important master's thesis. So late last night, I began to write. I slammed a couple Red Bulls, checked my Instagram feed for a couple dozen times, saw Danielle post something on Facebook that got over 100 likes in 20 minutes, watched a YouTube video called Cats Playing with Strings sent to me by Martha Warner. And then I got to work. You know, it's crazy to think that it's just been 2 years. 2 years ago, we were all living in different parts of the world. Our entire futures ahead of us, waiting in anticipation to start school, all of us thrilled to leave our dead-end jobs. And today, just moments away from graduating, we're probably all asking ourselves similar questions. What's going to happen to me? Will I find my place in the world? Can I please have my old job back? It's true. Unemployment's real, you know, it's very real. It feels like just yesterday when I shared news that every Vietnamese parent just dreams of hearing from their kid. Mom and Dad, I'm getting a master's in public policy. My parents had much bigger dreams for what I was going to accomplish in my life. And so needless to say, it was a minor disappointment. And so from time to time, they asked me, Van, have you considered doing something else? Do these classes count towards a pharmacy degree? And I get it. Both of my parents are refugees from Vietnam, came over here in 1975. Neither of them graduated from college, and so they have a very traditional view of what success looks like here in America. But when I really think about it, obtaining the skills that a Master's in Public Policy degree offers is probably more important now than it has been the last 50 years. And the reason why I say that is there's so much political noise drowning out rational, reasonable public debate on almost every major issue under the sun. And so it's in these moments that I think we need strategic, courageous public policy professionals like you all to cut through that noise and convey a vision for how we can solve the problems that we face in our society. And in every way, that's what I found here in all of you. When I decided to come back to Cal after 4 years of working in New York and Washington, D.C. at a healthcare union, beyond wanting to develop my own economic and quantitative skill set, I was searching to rekindle my motivation, to renew my spirit, and to be surrounded by people who aspired to do right by the world. I found that spirit here, a spirit that says that even though the challenges that we face are massive, and though the climate to create that change can be oftentimes hostile, and though the odds are most likely stacked against us, we have a group of students here that aspire to live up to the values of this great school and speak truth to power. Because the fact of the matter is, our class, the class of 2014, must be ready and willing to lead. And to me, that's what makes this class so special. You know, that we're not just content with simply learning the tools of public policy analysis, memo writing, statistical modeling, cost-benefit analysis, all of which are incredibly important, but they're wholly insufficient to deal with the challenges that we face today. So then the question becomes, are we ready? And if I'm being completely honest, there are many times I've felt paralyzed by the anxiety that comes with asking the question, what's the next step? What is my path? Will I make the right choice? What happens if I fall flat on my face? And though there are few certainties in life, all I know for sure is that we will certainly all fail at something. And that's okay. Because you see, graduating from the top policy school in the country, we all have a natural desire to be great at everything we do. And that can oftentimes be a huge strength. But sometimes it can be one of our biggest liabilities. It impedes our ability to take risks, truly lead, and to push ourselves to reach our highest potential. And so I want to, this quote that I heard from Dan Mulhern's leadership class that I took this last semester really crystallized this concept for me. Name any great leader, performer, scientist, athlete, activist, or citizen. Chances are that the crucible of that person's crowning achievement was some distressing crisis, wrenching change, tragic misfortune, or risky venture. Only challenge produces the opportunity for greatness. We will probably have little control over the crises, life-changing moments, or misfortunes that impact our lives, but we do have the ability to not just play it safe, but to choose our own risks and to reach our full potential. Whether it's in government, politics in government, business, or the not-for-profit sector, whether it's here locally in Washington, D.C., or somewhere else in the world, whether it's in the spotlight or some thankless role behind the scenes, I know this class is ready to lead. So here's what I wish for us, the class of 2014. I wish for us both the bad and the good, for both incredible triumphs and miserable failures, to take risks that make us feel uncomfortable, but allow us to live our lives to the fullest. Because when we look back on our lives, if we've taken these risks and learned from them and gotten back up and kept moving forward, I guarantee that we will be as nostalgic for the bad as we are for the good. So on Wednesday night at our graduation party, which was awesome, it hit me. The tequila shot that I took just moments earlier was a terrible idea. Thank you, Emily Vaughn. You are a terrible instigator. Where are you? There you are. There. Then another thought hit me. It was the realization that our imminent reality, that all of us would probably never be in the same room again, ever again in our lives. And that's just the truth of the matter. We will go on with our lives, meet new friends, establish families, go on to accomplish great things, so on and so forth. And then I begin to reflect on what I will actually remember from my time here at GCP. What I will remember and hold most dear are the relationships I've developed over the last 2 years. I will remember the kindness of people like Swati, who spent hours with me helping me learn how to write SAS code to pull out descriptive statistics for my APA. I will remember the true joy I felt when Satoru emailed me to let me know his first son was born. I will remember the generosity of people like Martha, Kari, Jalila, and Cecile, who contribute their time and knowledge to help us pursue our dreams. I'll remember Keith's memes. He doesn't deserve applause, don't you? Now, when we're old and gray, we will reflect back on these last 2 years as some of the best of our lives, and that's because of the relationships that we've been able to build. So I admit, I'm typically not big on celebrations for things like this, but for some reason, today feels a bit different. For most of us, this will probably be the last time we participate in a graduation ceremony of our own, except for maybe Anne, who probably will go to law school in the next couple of years. Don't do it. But today is uniquely special for me. It's incredibly humbling to be in the presence of my family, my future family, and my GSBP family. And I want to take this moment to thank them for all their support, not just in the last 2 years, but for my entire life. And to the class of 2014, I've enjoyed every minute of this ride with you. Enjoy this day, bask in the beauty of the relationships that you've been able to build the last 2 years, and continue to be bold, because that's exactly what this moment demands. Congratulations, class of 2014. Thank you. Can I take a picture of this? This is cool. Yeah. All right. So now I have the privilege of introducing our next speaker. If D star equals A sub N, I don't know how to complete this analogy because I'm terrible at economics. I just want to introduce Dan Acklin to the podium, who was chosen by our class to be this year's faculty speaker. Dan.
Thank you. MPP class of 2014, congratulations. And Sarah, congratulations. Our PhD graduate. Today we celebrate success, your success. You succeeded in making it through a year of quant and econ. You successfully navigated the perilous waters of IPA and the slightly less than 48-hour project. You successfully did whatever it took to keep body and soul together while taking four or even five classes at a time. And then you completed your APA, the ultimate hallmark of success at GSPP. So today, bask in the warm glow of success. Soak it in. Get your fill. Because failure awaits you. This I can promise. It's the theme for the day. You will go out here from here to tackle great challenges. Some of you will take jobs more demanding than any APA you can imagine. Some will start nonprofits or startups. Others will manage government agencies, propose legislation, run for office, lead movements, or conduct ambitious policy research. Of course, you will experience success a lot of the time. If I didn't believe that, I would quit my job immediately. But all of you, I promise you, will experience failure. Maybe you'll be overwhelmed by your demanding job. Maybe your nonprofit or your startup will wither on the vine. Maybe your legislation will die in committee. You'll lose the race, your movement will collapse, or your agency will wallow ineffectually despite your best efforts. And believe it or not, as unlikely as this may seem after your rigorous training at GSPP, if you're going out from here to conduct ambitious policy research, there is a non-trivial probability that it will simply disappear into the void. I'm not going to even begin to demonstrate how true that can be with reference to some of the people in this room. Now, because I take seriously my role in preparing you for a career in public policy, and because very few people could be more qualified to speak on this topic, I will now tell you the three things that I believe you need to know about failure. First, failure is normal. Everybody fails over and over again. Am I right? Am I right, everybody? Indeed, as you've probably heard before and will certainly soon learn for yourselves, failure is the only avenue to success. You cannot succeed at anything worth doing without failing along the way. If you're failing, it actually means you're doing something right, which is that you're showing up for the challenge. There's only one kind of person who never fails, and that is the person who never tries. So be prepared to fail and embrace it when it happens. You are on the road to success. Second, whether you succeed or fail is actually not up to you, not entirely. It is up to you to try, to take on the challenge, and to do your very best. No one else can do that for you, and it will not happen on its own. But whether or not you succeed depends on many factors that are simply not under your control. Lack of cooperation, institutional inertia, political gridlock, organizational dysfunction, or just the quotidian selfishness of the human species. You will encounter these obstacles on your road to success. Sometimes you will roll right over them, but sometimes they will stop you in your path, frustrate your very best efforts, and cause your endeavors to fail. But this does not mean that you failed. If you show up and do your very best, you have succeeded already. And even if the world does get in your way and blocks your path, you will learn from each failure. You will learn the lessons of life, the tricks of the trade, and the ways of the policy world. Each failure will make you wiser and stronger. Indeed, any failure you can learn from is actually a success. Now, the third thing you need to know about failure is almost certainly going to sound trite. So first, let me say that in my experience, when a truth sounds trite, it's usually because I haven't suffered enough yet to realize how truly untrite it actually is. So keeping that in mind, the third thing that you need to know about failure is that failure isn't when you get knocked down. Failure is when you don't get back up. Sounds trite, right? Until you've been knocked down and gotten up, been knocked down again, and gotten up again, and been knocked down again, and again, and again. If you want to make a difference in the world, this will be your life. Maybe your goal is to close the gender salary gap, which is starting to look like, in order to get there, we're going to have to change the entire culture of employment, so that there are more flexible work arrangements available in all occupations, and the big money doesn't always go to people who are willing to work 80 hours a week. Anybody want to conjecture how much failure there is down that road to success? What about the de facto apartheid regime we've turned our criminal justice system into? I'm afraid there's still an awful lot of failure down that road, Eric Holder notwithstanding. Maybe you're determined to overcome the meth epidemic in rural America, or unionized trash pickers in Delhi. I could just go down the list of every single policy issue you guys have ever cared about. Money in politics, economic inequality, the decline of our education system, etc., etc. You're setting off down some very rough roads. You will get knocked down. That's not failure. Only if you give up will you have failed. But you don't get to give up, because you now belong to GSPP, and we don't give up It's not the GSPP brand. Are we clear on that? More importantly, you don't want to give up. There'll be days when you forget this. There'll be days when the best idea you can come up with is to lie down on the floor and sob yourself into exhaustion. You will tell yourself that nothing is working, that you've completely failed, and that you want to give up. This, by the way, is also normal. I know this because it's happened to me so many times that I eventually had to ask my therapist, is this in fact normal? Yep, turns out it's normal. But it isn't true. You don't want to give up. You have to teach yourself to remember this. You didn't want to give up last week, and you will not want to give up this time next week. So let yourself lie down on the floor for a minute those times. Take a rest. Flush out your ducts. By all means, have a good old cry. But then get up and get going again. You are on the road to success. And we're on it with you. Everyone in this room is here for you. You have your family and friends to turn to when you need to be lifted up and dusted off. And I think I can speak for all of us on this stage when I say that your diploma comes with a lifetime of free customer support. Call us up. Send us an email. I'm serious. We've got your back. And you've got each other and all the MPPs who come before you. As of today, you are GSPP alums, which means you're part of a rich network of support. They've got your back, too. And believe it or not, with very few exceptions, the people you are going out into the world to work with will be human beings as well. And you will be surprised how much support you can get from ordinary human beings by just asking for it. So get out there and tackle those challenges. Show up and do your best. And for God's sake, hurry up and get knocked down a few times. But always get back up. Every time you do, congratulations. You're on the road to success. Now it's my pleasure to introduce a couple of students who are going to present the class of 2014 class gift to the school. Let's see which way they're coming up. This is Raphael Barsham and Jonathan Eidsvog.
Good morning. We are the class of 2014 class gift committee, especially for those of you who haven't read your email in 2 months. But way back in the earlier part of this year, our class voted to devote our gift to scholarship funding to help future students attend the Goldman School and get as much from it as we have.
So as a class, we've donated $2,505. Including supporting matching funds, that total amount raised is $7,835. I may be coming out to collect more money, so please answer your door, read my emails. We'd like to thank Martha Chavez, Lynn Serta Price, faculty, staff, family, friends, and of course, our classmates. Congratulations. Now it's my pleasure to introduce Professor Lee Friedman, who will introduce the Outstanding GSI Award.
Good morning and welcome everybody. And congratulations to our about to be graduating class and to their families and loved ones. My name is Lee Friedman. I teach the core graduate class in microeconomics, as well as some elective seminars for the students. And I was asked to present one of the awards for the Outstanding Graduate Student Instructor this year. We have two awards. Departments make nominations to the central campus, and then the central campus decides who gets the award. So we're very fortunate that we have two out of some more than 30 graduate student instructors that work for us and really do wonderful, wonderful work. I'm pleased to present the first Outstanding GSI Award to Daniel Baker, who was a GSI in the microeconomics course. Daniel, if you would please come to the stage. This course is, of course, a very important course. It's taken by all first-year graduate students, and it has a lot of impact in terms of what they will do with their lives. So we like to get it right, and it's especially nice when you have outstanding graduate student instructors who can help get that right. I've also had the privilege not of just working with Daniel, but I've had him in several of my courses. In one of the courses, he was interested in the stability of preferences. We try to train all of our graduates to serve the people, to have government serve the people, and do it well. And sometimes we have a conundrum when people want different things, they change their minds, they change what they want, and we don't always know about it so fast. So we worry about the stability of these preferences. Well, one of the preferences that's been stable and that I'm very happy about that it's been stable has been Daniel's preference to be and to enroll in the PhD program. He knew that he wanted to do that 1 year before he came to GSPP. He's worked assiduously at it. He continues to have that stable preference, and he has been admitted to the PhD program, and he will be staying on. Not only is it important that he did such a good job as a teacher to the first-year students this year, but to all the future classes that he will teach, and I'm sure there will be very many of them. It's not easy to be a good teacher. You have to have not only a command of the material itself and know that cold, but you have to be able to understand how your students think about that material, because what you're trying to teach is them to think about the material and use it on their own. And Daniel has the characteristic that he's a very good listener, he's very perceptive about other people's thoughts, and that helps him to be the outstanding teacher that he is. So Daniel, let me find your plaque and congratulate you. And now let me call Professor Hilary Hoynes to the podium to present the second Outstanding GSI Award.
Welcome, everybody, once again, 2014 graduates to be and family and friends. It is with great pleasure that I get to award the second Outstanding GSI Award today to Corey Reynolds. I know you're sitting in the back, Corey, so why don't you start to make your way up. So despite the fact that we're all here for the main event of the Master's in Public Policy program and PhD program at the Goldman School, we've got another operation that goes on at the school that is large and thriving and oversubscribed, and that is our undergraduate minor in public policy here at Berkeley. It's a very popular minor program, and it attracts students from really across the campus in terms of their majors. And I had the great pleasure in my first year here at the Goldman School to teach in the public policy minor, and in particular, the core kind of gateway course known as PP101, or Introduction to Public Policy Analysis. And this is the one required course for the undergraduate minor. And I had the great fortune to have Corey as one of my three GSIs in teaching this course this spring semester. And Corey also was a GSI for the course in the fall. And just to give you a little bit of an idea of what kind of challenge lies in teaching and coordinating this course, we had a little over 90 students in our course, and we polled the students at the beginning of the term to find out where they're coming from, because after all, these are all minors. And we had about more than 20 different majors represented in our class of 91 students. These students came from political science, political economy, economics, peace and conflict studies, philosophy, sociology, all the way to biology, molecular and cell biology, public health, and so on. About half of the students hadn't had any economics since high school, and that, given my background in economics, was really the analytical core for the course. And so with this incredible diversity and amazing different voices in the class, I came in as a new professor who had never taught in a school of public policy. I'm a seasoned professor, but it's my first year teaching at the Goldman School. And I really wasn't quite sure what Introduction to Public Policy Analysis was. Sorry, Dean Brady. And I think to the extent to which the class was a success, and we'll find out, it was very much largely in part to the three GSIs I had who helped school me in what public policy was. And I am especially appreciative to Corey. Not only does he have the incredible skills in the classroom, the way he works with students, his attention, his patience, his guidance, his humor, but he was also incredibly helpful to me because of his experience as a second-year MPP, because he had TA'd the course in the fall. I'm really not sure I could have done it without him. So it is with great pleasure that I have the opportunity to award Corey Reynolds the second Outstanding GSI Award.
That's so great. I so appreciate it.
Let's make sure we get a photo.
Oh, okay.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Stephen Raphael. I'm a professor here at the Goldman School. Every year, our MPP graduates are in their second year of the program. They perform a capstone master's thesis, which is often a consulting project for a real client, where real clients from government, from nonprofits, and various other organizations identify problems, and our students work on them. They actually do amazing, amazing reports. If you look through your program in front of you, you'll find a list of the titles that each one of the students have completed for this particular year, and you just read through them, and it's frankly amazing the things they do. It's great because we interact quite a bit as professors in our scholarly work with government officials, and they're always really happy, and we could just take credit. You know, we touch everything we know. So it's really a wonderful program. Every year, each APA section, the Advanced Policy Analysis section, nominates their best APA forward for the Eugene Smolensky Prize. So the Smolensky Prize was established many years ago to honor, it's an honor of our former dean, Eugene Smolensky, and it honors the strongest APA of the year. So I have the pleasure this year of announcing the winner. And before we do that, what I'd like to do is just announce all of the names of the people who were nominated. And when I announce your name, would you please stand up? Kalei Anno. Okay. Evan Axelrod. Marinella Boyajiev. Kate Daniel. Tim Morrison. Anna Skodel. And Tara Zhang. And I am pleased to announce that this year's winner of the Smolensky Prize for Outstanding Advanced Policy Analysis is Rebecca Tublitz. So, Rebecca, would you please come up to the podium? So you guys want to hear what she did? Yeah, okay. So Rebecca wrote her APA for the Police Department of East Palo Alto. For those of you from the area, you probably know where East Palo Alto is, but it's a very small city in the Bay Area that has one of the highest violent crime rates and the highest rates of unlawful gun carrying and gun shooting and violent incidents such as that in the area. The East Palo Alto Police Department started a new program called Fit Zones, where they identified the two spots in the city that had the highest incidence of gunshots. And they basically started a program where the police would hold classes in the park, they would have Zumba classes, they would have nutrition classes and various activities that got the community and the police to interact with one another in a way that sort of built community and didn't involve simply enforcing the law. Rebecca was asked to evaluate whether it worked. The principal aim of the program was to reduce illegal gunshots. She managed to get data that identified every single gunshot in the city from these audible detectors that would pinpoint gunshots in terms of time and space with geographic coordinates. She did a very, very sophisticated analysis of what happened to gunshots in the neighborhoods of these fit zones, and then what happened to gunshots in the neighborhoods outside the neighborhoods of these fit zones to essentially see if illegal activity was displaced to other areas, and actually found an impact, right, that this, at least for one of the fit zones, that this particular intervention, which wasn't a law enforcement intervention, was quite effective at reducing gunshots in this city. So it was a fantastic project, and it was a pleasure to work with Rebecca, and I'm going to be happy to take credit for you later on. So please, Rebecca.
That's just one example of the great work that our students do in the APAs. As I say, it's a substantial amount of consulting work done for free for governments and nonprofits and other organizations, and we're really proud of what we do. Indeed, I remember about 2 years ago I was talking to people in the legislature about how we'd like to build stronger relationships with them and help them do more APA kind of work. And I just gave them a list that Martha Chavez had put together of all the APAs. And they started looking at it, and they said, well, I want that, I want that. And they started checking ones. They said, can you get me copies of these things? And so I felt good about the fact that our APAs were in demand. I was a little worried that it wasn't clear to me that they had as much knowledge and information as they needed to be governing us. But one of our goals is to fix that problem. Term limits haven't helped. The gutting of various professional organizations that provide advice to the legislature hasn't helped. And, of course, we're sort of in an evidence-free world these days, which is not good. And the Goldman School of Public Policy is very much about let's bring evidence to bear because it matters what the facts are. And so although Dan is right, there's going to be failure in trying to bring the facts to bear. We see that in a lot of areas of public policy right now. At the same time, I think we got to keep doing it. Because I think in the long run, I'd like to believe that the facts will have an impact. Certainly when Florida is 6 feet underwater, one suspects that there'll be fewer climate deniers. But who knows? Who knows? Maybe there'll be other explanations, like Florida sank or something like that. Okay, so it's my privilege now to introduce our graduation speaker. Ben Rhodes is the Assistant to the President and Deputy National Security Advisor for strategic communications and speech writing, a job you can imagine that is fraught with lots of complexities these days. He oversees President Obama's national security communications, speech writing, and global engagement. He has traveled with the president in various places. So the president has gone abroad and made speeches and talked with world leaders. So he's had some extraordinary experiences through those trips. Previously, he served as deputy director of the White House speech writing, and he was a senior speechwriter for the Obama campaign. So he's been with the Obama campaign since very, very early, going back to before Obama was elected president in 2008. And prior to joining Obama, he worked for several years as special assistant to Lee Hamilton. Lee Hamilton may not be well known on this coast, but he was a member of Congress, and he's one of those members of Congress I wish we had a lot more of. An exceptionally knowledgeable, exceptionally talented guy who really brought evidence, knowledge, information to bear on public policy. So Ben Rhodes worked with him at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. There he helped draft the Iraq Study Group report, which Lee Hamilton was involved with, and the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. He is co-author with Lee Hamilton and Tom Keene of Without Precedent, the Inside Story of the 9/11 Commission. So he's really dealt with some of the fundamental issues, 9/11, Iraq, and now all the issues confronting the Obama White House, the fundamental national security and international issues confronting the world and the Obama administration. He's a native of New York City. He has a BA from Rice University, so he knows Texas as well as the East Coast, and has an MFA from New York University, where he actually learned to write fiction. And I think he's going to tell you a little bit about how that maybe is different than what he does now, which is try to communicate the president's perspective, which some people might want to pretend or presume is fiction. But in fact, I imagine that he's trying really, really hard to provide the evidence and the information that we all need to actually understand the world. Thank you, Ben Rhodes, for coming here, and welcome.
Well, thank you, Dean Brady, Dean Chavez, the faculty and staff of the Goldman School. To the family and friends of the graduates who are here, and above all to the class of 2014. It's an honor to be with you here today, and thank you for getting me out of Washington for the weekend. As a commencement speaker, I also am acutely aware of having sat here that I'm the only thing standing in between you and this pile of diplomas here, and the failures that will follow getting those diplomas. So maybe I'll go on a little longer. At 36, I know I'm young to be a commencement speaker. That does mean, though, that I have a fairly recent memory of sitting where you are today. I don't remember much about what my commencement speaker said. I remember kind of shaking off a night before. I remember planning where we're going to go to lunch with my family. And I remember wondering what on earth I was going to do with the rest of my life. I can't help on the first two, so I'll focus my time on the third. Usually, I work on speeches like this for President Obama. So the most natural thing for me to do would be to tell you about how, when I left school, I packed up my car and moved to the south side of Chicago to be a community organizer. I can't use that story today. It's too bad because it works every time. But I'll share a few thoughts rooted in my own experience. Because I've had the profound honor, really, of working in the White House and at a young age, I do often try to meet with students who come to town, and public policy students in particular. And they walk into my office, which is in the West Wing, but you know, it's one of those windowless offices like you always look forward to occupying. And I notice that their eyes often turn to a photograph on the wall while they're talking to me, and it's a photograph of me with then-Senator Obama and Dennis McDonough, who's now the White House Chief of Staff, on the first day that I worked for then-Senator Obama in early 2007. And I kind of see what they're thinking as they look back and forth at the photo of me. The president has that dark hair of the campaign posters of 2008. Dennis has dark hair. I have hair. And a lot's changed for the three of us in the years since. But today I get to wear a hat, so that's a good thing. But that wear and tear has, of course, been worth it. And so with the rest of my time, I'll answer the question that students most ask me, which is, what kind of plan should they have when they leave school and pursue careers in this field? And I'll just make five brief points. The first point is, don't have a plan. Plans sometimes work for public policy, sometimes they don't. But in life, sticking to a plan limits your options. It tends to rule out risk-taking, and no plan can account for luck, which you're going to need, and bad luck, which is going to come as well. So from love to work, you'll find that so many of the best things that you'll encounter in life are unplanned, and you have to see where those things take you, and you have to get up, of course, after the inevitable failure. The second point is to connect your story to the wider world. In some ways, you made that choice by focusing on policy. When I was in grad school, as was said, I got a master's in fiction writing, which does provide endless material for critics of the president and critics of myself. If you Google me, you'll find that. But in addition to going class when I was at grad school, I had jobs teaching community college, working as a researcher for CBS Sports, giving out free shots of Jägermeister in bars. They did pay for that. But also working on local political campaigns. So I had lots of different interests, and I didn't know exactly where I was going to go. The natural progression for me coming out of a program like that, I would go into publishing and trying to write one of those novels about a young writer trying to write a novel in New York City. Very rich material. Then one morning I was handing out flyers for a city council campaign in Brooklyn that I was working on. And it was primary day, September 11, 2001. And from where I was on the Brooklyn waterfront, I saw the second plane hit and the first tower fall. And suddenly my little world got a lot bigger. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew that whatever I was going to do next, I wanted to be a part of how the world was going to respond to what I'd just seen. And for me, that choice, that sense of the world opening up for me, made all the difference. It led me down to offices in Washington where I tried to talk my way into jobs as a writer for foreign policy magazines. That didn't work, but one of those editors was nice enough and wise enough to tell me that if I wanted to write and learn about foreign policy, I should become a speechwriter, something that, until that moment, had never even occurred to me. And that's what led me to Lee Hamilton. So it may not be something as dramatic as 9/11, but every day there are changes that are remaking our world, that are moving us towards war or towards peace, that are breakthroughs in everything from healthcare policy to urban planning to fighting crime, to the new demands that come from transformative change in technology or the climate. And your world, your opportunities, will be a lot bigger if you figure out how to connect your story to those events that are taking place around you. The third point is to find your own voice, which is an easy thing for a speechwriter to say. But let me try to explain that a little bit by telling you a story about a speech. And that's a speech that President Obama delivered the night of the New Hampshire primary in 2008. And you have to remember the time. We had won Iowa. We were way up in New Hampshire. So we pulled together all of the different messages of that campaign and tried to distill it into the core of the message. And then we concluded the speech with a call and response using then-Senator Obama's 2004 slogan, "Yes, we can." Normally, you write two speeches for an election night. A losing speech and a victory speech. But we didn't bother with the losing speech because we were so far up in the polls. We had it locked up. And then he lost. It was too late to write a new speech, so we just changed the first line of the speech to congratulate Hillary Clinton for her hard-fought victory, and we kept the rest of the speech the same. And you know what? It was better as a losing speech because it was all about overcoming long odds. Now, why did it work? Putting aside the Will I Am video. It had nothing to do with speechwriters, really, because what I always tell people is if you close your eyes and you imagine any other political figure delivering the same speech, you know, Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan or Jesse Jackson or John Kerry, it wouldn't work at all. But by January of 2008, Barack Obama had his own voice and his own message. It set him apart from other people, and it carried him, and probably, into the White House. So why is this relevant to you? Well, no matter what you choose to do, you're going to need your own voice. You're going to have to find what makes you different from everybody else. You are graduating from the number one public policy graduate school in the country and the world. But a whole bunch of people graduated from here last year. A whole bunch of people are going to graduate from here next year. This week, this month, there are a whole bunch of other schools handing out diplomas like this from top-tier schools. So you have to figure out what's going to make you different from those people. Wherever you go, whether it's politics or government, the private sector, nonprofits, the academics, you're going to figure out what experience and expertise, what passion, what type of personality is going to make you different from everybody else in the room. If you do that, it will work out whether you win or lose, whether you succeed or fail. The fourth point, public policy matters. It really does matter. I'll tell one story to highlight that. In November of 2012, President Obama became the first U.S. president to visit Burma. In a country where it used to be illegal to just gather in a crowd, there were tens of thousands of people lining the motorcade route. In the house where Aung San Suu Kyi was imprisoned, she sat down at a small table with Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and talked about her work in Parliament. And then we went to a university that had been shut down because of its role in the democracy movements and had been reopened for this occasion. And the president addressed an audience that included both political prisoners and the government officials who had put them in prison and then released them. So it was an exciting moment. And it was a sign that policy can affect change over a long period of time in an area like foreign policy. But then I went back to Burma by myself last summer. And what I found is what they needed more than anything else was you. In building after building, I met with minister after minister. And these are like big cavernous buildings that the Chinese helped them build back before they decided to move in a different direction. And some of these ministers were dedicated reformers. Some of them probably aren't. But whatever you think about the will of that government to reform, they needed to know how to reform. They needed public policy experts. They needed to know how to map their terrain and figure out how to get agricultural goods to market. They needed to know how to write laws to reform how land is owned or how media can operate. They needed people who could turn ceasefires with ethnic insurgencies into lasting national reconciliation. They're not going to make it unless they can find people like you. You know, so much upheaval in our world today is rooted in a desire by people to have a say in how they're governed. But it's also about having a government that can respond to people's aspirations. It's one thing to put 100,000 people in a square. It's a lot harder to root out the corruption that put them in the square in the first place. But that's the long game. That's ultimately what public policy, and only public policy, can do. That's what's going to determine whether, in 5 years or 10 years, people would rather live in Crimea or Kiev, in Damascus or in Tunis, in Pyongyang or Rangoon. The fifth and final point is don't give in to cynicism. I'll admit, every day, Washington gives me plenty of reasons to give in to cynicism. Some days more than others, too. But, you know, it's easy to slip inside a bubble when you're in Washington. It's actually kind of interesting that being in Washington, sometimes you lose sight of the importance of public policy because it's a place where sometimes the thing that matters most is the next election and all the noise that feeds the beast until then. And in this world, facts are less important than opinion. Conflict is more valued than competence. And campaigning often matters more than governing. But for all the focus on that, that has nothing to do with how change actually happens in people's lives. I wrote a lot of speeches in the 2007-2008 campaign about ending the war in Iraq. You know how many troops that brought home from Iraq? None. But then when I was in government, I was able to sit in the Situation Room in the first weeks of the presidency and see President Obama make a decision, communicate a decision to his military to have a withdrawal plan for Iraq. And all of those troops came home. That's actual change. There's a lot of people that you can turn on the TV and see any day talking about repealing Obamacare. They say other things about Obamacare, too. But do you know how many people that has helped? None. But 8 million people signed up for the healthcare exchanges while those people were talking on television. That's actual change. So you just have to remind yourself that there's the noise and then there's the actual work of public policy. We were talking about climate change. And you still have, Washington is one of the few places in the world where it's still controversial to acknowledge that human beings might have something to do with climate change. For all that noise, even as there's difficulties in Congress, the president is now looking at ways, again, of reforming how we use coal-fired power plants, how we finance our energy sector, how we develop clean energy. You can make change even when the environment around it can seem to be frustrating and disappointing and let you down. And this extends far beyond the kind of big headline issues that people focus on a lot. You know, one of the things I get to do in my job is work on our public diplomacy and our education exchange programs. These are not things that get headlines. But it's amazing to see how they can change lives. In 2009, for instance, President Obama decided to send more English language teachers to villages in Malaysia. When I traveled to Malaysia last year, first of all, these teachers were like professional athletes in the Malaysian media. People knew where they were, and they were kind of celebrated for what they were doing. So I knew the program was a success. But I got to sit down and meet with some of those teachers and their students. And as we were going around, people were telling stories about how meeting these Americans changed their views of America. There was one kind of student who looked like I wasn't sure that he was happy to be there. You know, he was kind of staring at the table, and I wasn't sure what he was going to say when it was his turn. He was a teenager. It's a difficult phase, or at least it was for me. When it got to him, I asked him, what did you get out of this experience? And other people had told long stories, and he just said, courage. And then I looked over at his teacher, and I said, well, what are you going to miss about this young woman who's been your teacher? And he kind of looked down at the table, and he said, her smile. You know, that's a connection that was forged by public policy, but cannot be underestimated. The accumulation of all of those types of activities add up to something much bigger that can't even be quantifiable, even with the best cost-effective analysis. Half a world away in Benin, there was a young woman named Kate Puzi, who was like that teacher. Kate was a Peace Corps volunteer. In a blog, she wrote about teaching 22 girls about self-confidence, good decision-making, family planning, women's health, conflict resolution, and healthy communications. Within a few months of that time, she was murdered after she courageously reported that she thought children were being abused at a school where she worked. Kate's family decided to make sure that other Peace Corps volunteers had greater protections than she had. So there are clear guidelines for dealing with assaults, and volunteers who report crimes have the confidentiality they deserve. And her brother, David, who's been a student here and is here today, he reached out to countless congressional offices. He called one after another, and one that he found actually was an office where my wife, Ann, worked. And they worked for months and months and months on this bill. And it was over, you know, initially there was reluctance by the Peace Corps to support it, but they had to bring past abuses to light, and they had to do something very difficult in Washington today, which is find a bipartisan consensus in support of this. And they got that bill passed. And I met David briefly outside the Oval Office for the first time before he and his family then watched President Obama sign the bill that was named for Kate Puzi into law. And that's change. That's change that's going to, again, change the way that the Peace Corps operates and the way that young Americans can be protected around the world. That bill was signed on November 21st, 2011. Almost exactly 2 years later, I joined President Obama in another Peace Corps commemoration, and this was the 50th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's assassination. And we marked that in the Situation Room in a conference room that was named after John F. Kennedy because he had built that facility because of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And we were joined by members of the Shriver family and Harris Wofford, who helped start the Peace Corps. And at exactly 2 p.m., the time that President Kennedy passed away, we observed a moment of silence And then the president spoke by video conference with Peace Corps volunteers in Tanzania, who talked with pride about the work they were doing. So President Kennedy's legacy is the Peace Corps that Kate Pusey served in. Kate Pusey's legacy is a Peace Corps in which those volunteers in Tanzania are more protected. Both of them were taken from us, but their life lives on in other people. And that's the change that public policy can bring to people around the world. And shame on anybody who would give in to cynicism, given the sacrifices that people like that have made. When you leave here, I can guarantee you one thing. You will hear from a lot of people who run down the notion of public service or the idea of government itself. There's a whole industry dedicated to that these days. It's doing quite well. I can personally vouch for that. But don't listen to those people. There have always been people who have stood in the way that, of the progress that public policy can bring. Those are not the people that are remembered. They never brought a smile to the face of a child a half a world away in Malaysia or Benin, or they never brought a better life to the family next door, whether it's a family that wants to live in a safer community in East Palo Alto, or a family that wants to know that they can have health insurance without going bankrupt. So cynicism is easy. Anybody can do that. Change is difficult, and it's going to take you. Really, if we could clone you, we'd be better off, given the need for good and better public policy across this country. So my advice before you take this piece of paper is never forget what made you care about these issues in the first place. Connect your story to something bigger that is going on around you. And also never forget that each and every one of you can and will change the world in a way that is totally unique. Don't ever forget that. Congratulations.
So one of the greatest honors that we have as faculty members is to award the PhD degree to some of the best young minds in the country that happen to come here at Berkeley. So we have one PhD today, Sarah Tahamont. Would you please come up to the stage? So before we talk about what Sarah did, I just want to let everybody know, getting a PhD is a heavy lift, right? And it is a lot of work. It takes an enormous amount of dedication and an enormous amount of self-direction and tenacity. We require that the students become experts in statistical modeling and behavioral modeling, and that they master various subfields, that they become professors. And the most difficult thing is they have to create new knowledge. So a PhD has to go out there and generate something which is new, useful knowledge about the world. And given that it's a public policy degree, oftentimes things that's going to help the world be a better place. Sarah has been one of the most amazing students that I've had the opportunity to work with over my career. Sarah, in addition to mastering all of the statistics and behavioral models, wrote an incredible dissertation on how the conditions of confinement in American prisons impact people's behavior while they're incarcerated. So in the United States, we have more people in prison than anywhere else in the world, and the one thing that few people realize is that 95% of people who are in prison will be released one day and they'll be back in our community. And so it's very important to know how the experience impacts them. And we know that in many instances there are positive things that happen in prison. There's some rehabilitative programming, educational programming. But we also know that there's a lot of bad things that happen in prison, that people become acculturated to prison environments, that they become influenced by their peers, and that many recidivate at a very, very, very high rate. Sarah's dissertation looked at essentially the determinants of inmate misconduct. It's basically oftentimes felonious behavior while people are incarcerated. And in particular, she looked at two interventions or two aspects of what determines how people behave when they're incarcerated. First, to what degree does having visits from family while you're incarcerated either make things worse or make things better? Turns out that that's not a very easy question because oftentimes visits are used as a disciplinary tool for inmates that are not behaving. But Sarah found a very ingenious way to essentially identify whether there's a causal effect by exploiting the fact that there are some inmates that are housed very far from where they reside, and other inmates that are housed relatively closely, and she essentially used that to demonstrate that when inmates have contact with family and friends, they actually do better while they're incarcerated and get into fewer problems. The second part of Sarah's dissertation was Sarah did several in-depth analysis of the inmate classification system for the state of California that was essentially aimed at trying to understand how your peers in prison impact the likelihood that you get into trouble while you're incarcerated. And this was a truly Herculean undertaking that involved, you know, visiting prisons, looking at administrative data, working with correctional staff, and actually the Secretary of the Department of Corrections for the state, and ultimately resulted in research that actually changed the way things are done in the state for the better and probably afforded more freedoms to inmates who were well-behaved. So it was an excellent dissertation and has already had a lot of impact in the policy world. While she was doing this, she was also a professor in the San Quentin Prison University Project and was an active teacher the entire 4 years she was here. So she was just an amazing student, did excellent work, knew what she was studying, both on a personal level and both as a statistician and a behavior researcher, and really wrote a fantastic dissertation. So let's get on with the hooding then. Okay, so come on up. It is my pleasure to confer upon Sarah Tahament the Doctor of Philosophy degree in Public Policy.
And now we will begin the presentation of the Master of Public Policy degrees. Yeah. You ready? Yeah. India Alarcón. Yeah. Calais Anno. Evan Axelrad. Daniel Russell Baker. Raphael Barsham. Ashley Bliss Herrera. Maranella Boya Giev. Vivian Bronsolev. Joaquin Carbonell. Roy Chung. Ashley Elizabeth Clark. Alexandra Clark. Antoine Cherie Camo. Kovas. Matan Crichton. Fernanda Tomas da Rocha. Kate Daniel. Patricio Dominguez Rivera. Danielle T. Yuang. Jonathan Dill Eidsvog. Mary Claire Evans. Sarah Feuer. Chad Freishman. James Vito Geluso. Courtney Gill. Arata Gatto. Shilpa Grover. Charu Gupta. Rahim Hanifa. Amanda J. Hong. Suchin Jane. Dorothy Rose Rappaport Johns. David Jonas. Chelsea Kelleher. Andrew Stevenson Kenny. Kelly Jean Kirkpatrick. Allison Rose Knox. Painham Lee. Tanya Lone. Morgan Linnea Matthews. Kevin McNellis. Saki Mizoroki. Anne Morrison. Tim Morrison. Chaya Nayak. Keith Nevitt. Michelle Nguyen. Van Nguyen. Natasha Nikolai. Shireen Panahande. Swati Subuth Pandey. Ananda Swami Paramasivan. Vishal Pegani. Christina Jade Pena. Rapichan Ta Purisamban. Anna Raskiza. Jessica Reed. Corey Reynolds. Kevin Ritchie. Carolina Rivera Vasquez. Hector S. Rosecrans. Anna Skodel. Christina Sedney. Ujala Shankar. Shahoye Shojai. Maggie Stakely. Lul Tesfai. Dan Thompson. Rebecca Tublitz. Emily Upstill. Olivia von Nieuwenhuizen. Lauren Ashley Vargas. Emily Vaughn. Sunny Bernard. David Weishar. Rachel Davis West. Satoru Yasuraoka. Mina Ho-Young Yu. Sarah Yuen Linville. Xiao Ding Zhu.
Well, have courage, everybody. We're almost finished. That's an important point, by the way. I really think courage is one of the fundamental things that good public policy analysts and leaders in the public sector need these days. You've heard people talk about failure today. You've heard them talk about how tough it is to get things done. But what you need is courage. 2 years ago, I was in China, in Taiwan, actually, and I met with somebody who had been through one of our executive programs. He's a doctor. He's now running a hospital. He had decided to help save a leper colony in Taiwan, the only one left that was at risk of being closed because of a metro station that was going to go through that area. And he managed to do that. And I asked him, well, what did you learn when you came to our program? What was it you got out of it? And he said, courage. And that really is an important thing. Have the courage to take risks. Have the courage to try to do things that you're not even sure you could possibly do. choose to try to do really hard things. That's what I think distinguishes Goldman School graduates. And I'm hoping we helped give you the basis to have that courage, because you have learned how to think about public policy and how to implement public policy, I hope you have the courage to say, why not? Let's try it. Maybe we can get it done. And if we do, it'll be wonderful. So, with that, I ask the graduates to stand. The first thing I want to do is thank our faculty, but especially our staff, who just do such a fabulous job here, for this event and for all the other wonderful things they do for us. So thank you to them. But now I get to say the one official thing I get to do every year. It's really wonderful. By virtue of the authority vested in me by the President and Regents of the University of California, I grant you this degree from the Goldman School of Public Policy. Congratulations.